ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
And this is the NT Country Hour on ABC Radio Darwin and the Northern Territory.
G'day, welcome to the program. My name's Fiona Broom. Great to have your company on this Tuesday lunchtime. Another boatload of foreign fishers who were picked up in Northern Territory waters have appeared this morning in Darwin local court. You'll hear more on that ahead on today's show. And in the past, Australia has imported grain for feed during times of drought. Could imported hay now be on the cards? And what happens after you win the Northern Territory's Rural Women's Award?
Definitely has been a whirlwind. A lot of work going on in the background that people probably don't realise. It's not just an award that you're given, it's an award that you work for.
All that and more coming up on the Country Hour. Let's get amongst it. And as always, the text line is open. You can share your thoughts with me. 0487 991057 is the text number to reach me on. Australia's beef industry says it wants to achieve 100% use of pain relief during surgical procedures on cattle within 5 years. But right now, how widespread is the use of anaesthesia, the use of pain relief for things like dehorning, castration and spaying? Dr. Michael Lawrence is the program manager for animal wellbeing at Meat and Livestock Australia. He says industry needs to be looking much more closely at this issue.
So the use of pain relief in cattle is an interesting area of discussion. We still use surgical husbandry to manage various things in our production systems, like we castrate male cattle, we spay females, and we take horns off horned animals, and those are painful, bloody surgical procedures, but they're necessary to control the management system. The thing is, they are painful, and more and more there's like an obligation on our industry to provide whatever pain relief we can to the animals to help them to thrive, and just because it's an expectation that if we can do it, we should.
Why is that obligation more and more coming up, in your opinion?
Well, that's a good question. And today, I'm not so much talking about pain relief and whether or not it works or not, because there are some questions about how effective it actually is. But I'm more talking about the need to show that we're using pain relief, because I think there's a bit of an existential risk that if we don't use the pain relief products that are available to us to the full extent that we can, that will reflect badly on the industry's commitment to maintain high animal welfare standards. And while the use of pain relief is only somewhat embedded in legislation, I think there's a chance that could get more impactful in time, and that will expose some producers who are perhaps not using it as much as they can or should.
We're here at Beef Up here in Alice Springs, and you're speaking to a group of Centralian pastoralists and people working in the cattle industry. What message are you trying to get across to them today in speaking on this topic?
Well, my main message is use pain relief for surgical husbandry. Just simply do it. So many people will say that there's no measurable production benefit to using pain relief products. And I think that's sort of somewhat true, but that's only because it's really difficult to measure the benefits. I think after 30 years of practicing as a veterinarian and having done postgraduate research into animal welfare, I can absolutely say that there is a benefit to the animals. It's just not always easy to categorize with data sets. So my message is use those products because it's good for the animals and it helps them produce better. It helps them recover better from the surgical husbandry procedures. So that's one reason to do it. But the other key thing is that the use of pain relief products in our industry is a very measurable metric. It's easy for our industry to to survey and ask questions like who's using pain relief and who isn't. And we need to show that the uptake of pain relief is going up because it speaks to our social license to keep farming the animals as we currently farm them.
As we know, there are a lot of Centralian producers who operate as organic cattle operations. What impact does the use of pain relief have on them?
So in the past, it's been more difficult for organic producers to use pain relief products like local anaesthetics and non-steroidal anaesthetics because they're sort of perceived as not necessarily organic in the true sense of the word. And I get that conundrum. That, I believe, is becoming less rigid as far as the organic certifying bodies go. And there are now opportunities for people to have veterinary oversight and consult with vets who formally prescribe those medications, and the organic producers can still stay within the bounds of their organic certification. And that's really an important thing to note because it gives those producers the opportunity to use not just natural solutions to pain and management procedures, but actually the synthetic products that we give to the animals to mitigate the pain. And to be honest, they are the ones that work the best.
And are we seeing any further progress and maybe having more pain relief options available to organic producers?
That's a very good question. There are more products coming online. They're all based around the same principle that they provide anti-inflammatory effects to the animals. They're all essentially non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, just in different forms. But the key thing that we're doing at MLA is trying to extend the duration of action of those drugs. So the best ones last for about 48 hours. Wouldn't it be good if we could give a single administration of a pain relief product for it to last sort of maybe 10 or even up to 15 days? So that's the sort of science we're looking at now.
What are the other areas you're looking to move that forward in this space?
Cattle don't respond well to most classes of pain relief, so we're kind of limited to the one area of research. But the thing is that the way we deliver that drug can be in different forms. You can put it on there into their mouth as a gel, you can give it as an injection, or perhaps we can even give it as an implant embedded within a nanoparticle mesh, which just pays out the drug for a long period of time. So that kind of science is really interesting to me because that's a way of extending the action of those drugs that we do have, and that's where our key focus is. There's no point in looking at things like opioids, which we use in humans, because they just don't work in cattle. The brains of the cattle don't have the same receptors to respond to those strong drugs like codeine and morphine and things. There's no point in giving them to cattle. So we're going to stick with the class of drug that we've got. We're just going to try and make it last longer.
That's Dr. Michael Lawrence, Program Manager for Animal Wellbeing at Meat and Livestock Australia. He was speaking there with Charles Geary. You can share your thoughts with me on any story on today's program. 0487 991 0057 is the text line. Joining you now on the program, Romy Carey, CEO of the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association. Good afternoon, Romy.
Good afternoon, Fiona. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Are Northern Territory cattle producers using pain relief for some of the husbandry procedures such as dehorning, castration and spaying?
Yes, absolutely. Great question. So dehorning and castration are essential management practices for the cattle industry. And our industry is absolutely using pain relief when undertaking these procedures. There's actually welfare guidelines that stipulate animals over 6 months of age when conducting dehorning or castrating must have pain relief used. However, it's widely adopted as a common practice for those procedures regardless of age within industry.
Some statistics I'm looking at here in last year's Australian Beef Sustainability Framework, that says that 30% of cattle producers across the country are using pain relief for these practices with aspirations to reach 100% by 2030. Do we have any data for the Northern Territory or broken down by jurisdiction in Australia?
So from the NT's perspective, from NTCA's perspective, apologies, I don't have specific data. However, I'm sure that our research organisations could look into that for you. However, anecdotally speaking, you know, widely discussed during throughout our membership are the benefits of the use of pain relief. The response that we see from our livestock when pain relief is used for those procedures, how they respond and recover. So we're extremely confident that within the Northern Territory there is a high uptake of that pain relief.
What are some of the benefits of using pain relief for dehorning and castration?
So we watch, obviously, our animals after these procedures stay relaxed. They return to food and water quicker. They're much more comfortable. So, you know, similarly to you and I, if we have a procedure undertaken, that pain relief provides us with relief following those procedures so that we can stay comfortable and return to normal as soon as possible.
Dr. Michael Lawrence from the MLA says some of the lack of evidence around the effectiveness of pain relief can lead to some people not adopting it. Are there some other reasons in the Northern Territory specifically that might lead to some producers opting to not use pain relief in these procedures?
I think that that's probably an individual producer question. However, you know, I'm not aware of reasons that people are not adopting pain relief. This, like I said, this is pain relief is widely adopted from our view across the Northern Territory. And I understand from listening to the interview that there aren't quantifiable or isn't quantifiable evidence around the requirement or the necessity for pain relief. But like I explained, you can certainly see it when you watch the animals come through the race and go back out into their paddock and straight back onto feed and water.
NT beef producers sell into a range of markets, including Europe. As part of ongoing EU free trade negotiations, there's been animal welfare groups in Europe calling for Australia to strengthen the mandate around the use of pain relief in cattle and sheep. MLA says stronger regulation may be on the way domestically. What does industry think about the prospect of greater pain relief regulation?
So like I explained, we've already got regulation in place. So dehorning and castration over the age of 6 months cannot occur without the use of pain relief. And we're really confident, like I said, that it's being adopted, you know, much sooner than that anyway for procedures that are happening during weaning. So I think the industry is really comfortable that we're performing to a standard currently.
Romy Carey, thanks for your time on the Country Hour this afternoon.
Thanks so much, Fiona.
My name's Jess Daniels. I'm a biosecurity liaison with the Northern Territory Cattlemen's Association, and you're listening to Country Hour.
NT Cattlemen's Association, Romy Carey, CEO, joining you just a moment ago on the Country Hour. Got a text in here from someone who wants to remain anonymous speaking on this pain relief issue. The text says, pain medication for surgical castration of animals. Yeah, cool, but what about non-surgical castration? Rubber ring castration is way more painful for heaps longer than the cutting method. This person says, I know, I've seen. Just because there's no blood doesn't mean it's kinder. Also, the burning method of dehorning is far more excruciating than cutting. This person says, I hope this stuff isn't just to help certain goody-goodies to feel better. Thank you for sharing your thoughts. You can send me a text, 0487 991057. Fiona Broom with you on the Country Hour this afternoon. Still ahead on the show, I'm going to bring you details from the latest foreign fishing case to be heard at the Darwin local court. And up next, is Australia considering importing hay? Stay tuned to your ABC. Bit of Slim Dusty and Joy McKean here on the Country Hour for your Tuesday lunchtime. I heard the bluebirds sing. It is 13 minutes to 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour. There's been a bit of rain forecast for the Northern Territory this week, and I think there might have even been some patchy showers about this morning. We will get some more detail on that from the Weather Bureau. We'll be chatting with them at 5 minutes past one. But the drought and the lack of rain are continuing in southern parts of the country. Southern producers are still struggling to source feed for livestock. And the Australian Agriculture Department is already in discussions with industry about preparations to import more feed. They're looking ahead to the case of a prolonged drought. Now, the last time Australia imported grain for feed was during the 2019 drought. But hay has never been imported into Australia due to high biosecurity risks. Assistant Secretary for Plant Import Operations with the Agriculture Department, Jacinta Copeland, explains more.
Well, we imported stock feed. It does present a high level of animal biosecurity risk due to its direct pathway to livestock. And it can also contain plant pests and diseases that have a negative impact on our agriculture and environment. So for that reason, we do impose strict controls on stock feed imports to make sure that the biosecurity risks are managed. But we do and we can import stock feed. The decision to import stock feed ingredients is a commercial decision by an importer. And the department's role is really to manage the risk of pests and diseases associated with those imports by administering biosecurity legislation.
So you mentioned there that we already do import feed. What kind of feed do we already bring in and where from?
The most common types are soybean meal, palm kernel expeller, which is commonly referred to as PKE, and copra meal, which is made from coconut kernels. Other less common meals that may be imported include dried distiller's grain, which is a byproduct of the brewing and ethanol industry, corn gluten meal, wheat gluten meal, and tapioca starch. And these products can come from all over the world. So North and South America, parts of Southeast Asia, as well as the Pacific.
So have we imported grain in the past, like during the Millennium Drought or some of these other droughts we've had?
Yes, we have imported grain in previous drought periods. The most recent was the 2019 one. We did import grain at that time.
What about hay? Have we ever imported hay into Australia?
Hay for stock feed is not imported into Australia due to the very high risk of it introducing both plant and animal diseases. So because of the wide range of risks associated with hay, any biosecurity treatment that would be required would likely make it commercially unviable.
At the moment, we're experiencing drought conditions. A lot of producers are looking for feed. It's becoming harder to source. Are we looking at potentially importing feed at the moment? Like, have you had people requesting permits at the moment, or we're not quite at that stage yet?
There are current permit holders experienced at importing these types of products. There has been conversations with Australian dairy farmers about the need for palm kernel expeller. We have been in touch with current permit holders. Obviously, we're not able to disclose who they are, but we are making them aware of the need for feed. And I do understand that there has been imports of palm kernel expeller into Victoria. Palm kernel expeller is a protein meal that is a byproduct from the extrusion of the oil out of a palm kernel.
Yeah, right. And it's for livestock feed? It's used for cattle and sheep, that kind of thing?
I understand it can be used as a feed ingredient for cattle. They do use it quite regularly in New Zealand.
Is this something that we're going to see more of, do you think, in the future as we experience more droughts?
I think we will, and that's some of the conversations that we're having with industry to start thinking and preparing for more drought situations. We do have a bulk grain import forum that we're hosting on the 27th of August, and this is really to help industry understand the requirements for bulk grain imports so they can start to prepare for those anticipated future drought cycles. Because it is a very complex import pathway, it's not something that can be quickly turned on once we hit that drought situation. We do need to be planning and preparing for it well in advance of any drought occurring.
How long in advance would you say you need to be preparing for this?
We are in talks with industry at the moment about undertaking a readiness assessment to examine our port infrastructure and storage capacity for imported grain if we did ever need to do that. It really is probably 1 to 2 years in advance of a severe drought situation happening that we would need to be putting plans in place and applying for import permits.
That's Jacinta Copeland, the Assistant Secretary of Plant Import Operations with the Federal Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, speaking there with Annie Brown.
We challenge you to step up and be a change maker.
The ABC is looking for trailblazers, 18 to 28, with a drive for making change in their regional communities. Applications close August 3. abc.net.au/trailblazers.
My name is James Gorry from TrainSafe NT. Just before you drive out bush, just do a quick inspection under your car or under the bonnet. So just keeping vehicles clean so we're not spreading biohazards, soil diseases or weeds. And enjoy listening to the Country Hour.
6 minutes to one here on the Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. On the Country Hour yesterday, you heard about the ongoing issue of illegal fishing in Northern Territory waters. More than 230 foreign fishers, you heard, have been prosecuted in the Darwin local court in the past 12 months, up from 75 prosecutions the year prior. That number for this year has gone up again. More fishers have gone through the court this morning. The ABC's Matt Garrick was there. Matt, what can you tell me?
Hello, Fiona. Well, look, I think the first thing that springs to mind over this morning's case, seven illegal fishers, alleged illegal fishers, fronted the court. They've all pleaded guilty this morning. People are really risking their lives out on the high seas, according to the defence counsel of these men today. We heard of these seven men who hailed from this small village in Sulawesi, and basically they come from complete poverty, a place where they have to travel to access running water. Mm. They're all young men between about 27 and 32, and essentially they've gone out on the sea, all from the same small village. They've gone out on the sea to try and make a buck, essentially, by fishing in Australian waters. The alternative where they're from is not much, according to their defence. It's essentially be a labourer where you'll get paid a very meagre allowance, whereas they can risk their lives, as is what happened according to both the defence and Crown prosecutor, with these seven men by going out to sea and trying to get a lucrative haul of trepang, which they can then on-sell.
Does the risk come in because they are not professional fishers? They don't have the skill to be on those high seas?
Yeah, absolutely. But also the state of their vessel. They had a, I think it was about 11 metres in size vessel. It was had three engines, but it was something like third hand. I think they said the vessel itself, which had these seven people on board, would be worth about $10,000 Australian. These people have hit rough seas, they've hit big swell, and their boat has started to break apart. Two of the three engines have essentially stopped working. They've drifted out at sea for 4 days. Mm. Some of these people, according to their lawyer, are the breadwinners for large families, you know, with their children and wives back home in some small Indonesian village. But they risk it all to try and get a haul of Australian marine life. They've ended up in mangroves in Melville Island, to try and get some protection from those rough seas. They've gone up a mangrove creek. They've been spotted. Defence has essentially found there was an illegal vessel in there. Defence couldn't get a Navy boat down these narrow mangrove creeks, so they had to wait for this boat, which, according to their lawyer, only had one engine left working to come out back to the high seas late at night, and as defence were essentially arresting them or taking on the boat, the bow ripped off and the boat essentially sank. So you can really see people are putting their lives at stake on our waters.
So if the boat was sinking, were they able to detect any catch on that boat? What were the charges against those seven men?
By accounts, they had no fish or trepang on board at the time of their being discovered. One thing the judge said was, look, just because they were unsuccessful fishers doesn't mean they weren't trying and doesn't mean that should lessen their sentence. They certainly had fishing gear on board. It was diving masks, reef walkers, gear that is associated with catching trepang or sea cucumber, as opposed to, you know, looking for reef fish. So it seems like they were probably targeted and they knew what they were doing. However, they weren't professional fishermen. They hailed from this small village and they could have gotten into some real trouble.
So what's the sentence? We've seen fines in the past. What's the sentence for these men?
Well, as of yet, the sentence is to be handed down at 2 o'clock today. Basically, their defence lawyer is saying they should be let off essentially with good behaviour bonds and sent back to Indonesia. Which would mean they would avoid significant imprisonment. So far, they've been detained in facilities in Darwin for the last 23 days, so that may count something towards their final sentence. Whether they get fined or not is what the judge will be deliberating. Part of the issue with the fines is these people come from such impoverished circumstances. Their defence lawyer, Lian Nguyen, says that they are unlikely to ever be able to pay even a small fine. The judge's argument is, well, then that's a deterrent if they have this fine hanging over their head that essentially acts as a suspended sentence for their life. However, whether that's fair or not, that's what he's going to be deliberating at the moment.
Alrighty, Matt Garrick, thank you for your time on the Country Hour this afternoon.
Thank you.
We will keep an eye on that case, bring you some more details when we have it. It is coming up to 1 o'clock. Heading over to the newsroom, I'll be back with you in 5 minutes.
Hi, I'm Eridani Mulder. I'm a senior wildlife ecologist at the Australian Wildlife Conservancy's Wongalara Wildlife Sanctuary, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Welcome back to the program. My name's Fiona Broom, keeping you company this Tuesday lunchtime. Ahead on the show, picture this. You've been named a finalist in the NT Rural Women's Award. You've then taken home that award. What happens next? Is it a cruisy ride or is it a whirlwind? You'll hear more on that coming up over the next half hour. We'll be hearing from Christy Hollis, the NT Rural Women's Award winner for this year. And it's citrus season. Those acidic little beauties, they're turning up everywhere in stores at the moment. But what are the juice prices doing? You'll find out what's happening in the orange juice market very shortly. But let's cross now to the Weather Bureau, find out what is happening there. Billy Lynch with us this afternoon. Good day, Billy.
Hi, Fiona.
I've heard that there was a bit of light drizzle in Alice Springs this morning, Billy, and I've seen that it's looking pretty cloudy and dark in Katherine. Is there a bit of rain about?
There was a little bit of rain about through Central Australia, yeah. So we had a trough and, what I'd call a weak cloud band move through southern regions like yesterday and overnight, and just brought a few showers with the passage of that trough. So Alice Springs Airport picked up 1 millimetre and the Alice Springs Desert Park 0.6 of a millimetre. And now that cloud is sort of breaking up and dissipating, but still some patchy cloud sort of between Alice and Tennant Creek at the moment. And then, up north in the top end, different sort of band of cloud has sort of pushed across the top end just from some moisture in the Timor Sea. So yeah, it is overcast in some parts of the top end. It's breaking up around Darwin, still quite cloudy around Catherine, but we're expecting that to dissipate, and by tomorrow it should be a sunnier day across the top end.
Okay, yes, that will answer the question someone has texted in. Why are we having constant cloud cover over the Edith area today?
Yeah, so there you go. Hopefully that answered that.
There we go. Now, yesterday we heard from Kaya that maybe about 10 millimetres, I think is what he said, might be on the way for Darwin towards the end of the week. I'm looking at my Bureau app now. It's saying 0 to 1 millimetres for Friday. What might be happening towards the end of the week?
Yeah, so, fairly settled conditions tomorrow, just as a high sort of moves across southern Australia. And then, yeah, it's Thursday and Friday, which is an interesting weather day. We'll get some very gusty northerly winds develop ahead of a trough and cold front, which will move across those southern regions of the Northern Territory during Thursday night and Friday. So, yeah, windy northerlies ahead of it, and then some much cooler southwesterlies behind it. And then it's also going to bring another cloud band, more significant than the one that happened in the last 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we're expecting, as Kai would have mentioned, quite widespread cloud and showers with that. And, yeah, rainfall totals do look like, you know, 5 to 15 millimetres, south of about Barrow Creek. And then, less than that, but there could be a few millimetres up in the Barkly and parts of the Tanami as well.
What about Yallara, Uluru?
Yeah, so they'll be in the thick of it for sure. So we'll start to see some of those showers develop during Thursday. And into Thursday night. But it will clear up fairly quickly as the cold front moves through. So Friday might start out a bit showery around Uluru, but clearing up. And, yeah, they're probably in the sort of the 10 to 15 mil likely range. Wouldn't rule out some slightly heavier falls as well across southern parts. But, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see.
Okay. What kind of temperatures might that cold front be bringing? Is it going to drop right down?
Yeah, it really will. So firstly, it will push up. So Alice Springs on Thursday forecasting 27 degrees and some parts, so sort of high 30s, even low 30s, high 20s to low 30s. And then, dropping significantly. So on the Friday, Uluru dropping down to 17. Alice Springs 22 on the Friday, down to 16 on the Saturday. So the weekend, will be right down into the mid-teens. And also once the cloud band clears and the clear skies, we're expecting quite cold, frosty temperatures. So good chance of some places dropping below zero. Tomorrow morning, but also again over the weekend.
Alrighty. You mentioned wind gusts, Billy. There was talk of sort of 50-kilometre-an-hour gusts. Are those still expected? I think it was across a few different forecast districts.
Yeah, I'd say easily 50-kilometre-per-hour gusts, probably stronger, in fact. So on the Thursday in the southwest, around Uluru and Wataka, that kind of region in the northerlies, I'd say we could get 40 to 50 kilometre per hour winds with gusts, and then stronger gusts, possibly 70 to 80 kilometre per hour gusts. That's
wow.
On Thursday. Yeah, it's quite significant.
Mm.
And then by Friday, it's the sort of the southeast corner, so the eastern Simpson and that southern Barkly region, similar wind strengths in the northerlies. Also the westerly change pushing through on the Friday, sort of south of Alice Springs around Culgera and Fink. Those westerlies will be very gusty as well. So going to push the fire dangers up. High fire danger, but not expecting any warnings at this point in time.
Okay, good idea. I guess if you're driving a big vehicle out there, to just keep an eye on those wind gusts as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Billy Lynch, thank you for your time on the Country Hour today.
No worries. Thanks, Fiona.
Billy Lynch there from the Bureau of Meteorology.
Rob Doyle here from Humpty Doo, Rambutan grower, and you're listening to the Country Hour.
Just coming up on 13 minutes past 1 o'clock here on the Country Hour, Fiona Broome with you this afternoon, filling in for Matt Bran. Now, I've noticed that the citrus right now is just delicious. I've really been enjoying, I don't know if they're tangelos or tangerines, the one with the sort of pointy bit on the bottom. Not quite an orange, not quite a mandarin. They're delicious, whatever they are. Also had a lovely orange last night that I picked up from the old Rapid Creek market. And orange juice prices, they have dropped to the lowest they've been in a decade after peaking last year due to global shortages. Jeff Nipsel is the joint managing director at the juice company Nippies. He says last year's high prices led to a consumer backlash, and that meant demand fell off, and that caused a juice surplus.
The juice side of things, we had a really strong demand year last year, and that's worldwide, and Australia got roped into that as well. And I think it'd be fair to say the juice industry got forced into paying some extremely high prices for juice quality fruit, which resulted in high prices for 2 litres at the retail level. And there's actually been a bit of an adverse reaction from consumers against, you know, let's say a typical 2 litre of OJ being up around $8 plus instead of around $6.90 or $7.20 or something in that order. And again, I think this rule has applied worldwide as well as Australia. There's been a bit of a consumer backlash at those high prices, and you know, we're kind of analysing along the lines of consumers seem to have decided you don't need to buy orange juice week to week. We can buy another juice or no juice at all. And the result of that thinking has actually caused quite a drop in demand to such a degree that what appeared to be a shortage of oranges worldwide and within Australia has now turned into a surplus. So the usual safety net that a juice price provides for an industry is now somewhat lower, and quite a bit lower than it was last year. And I'll just throw some numbers around. Last year, juice prices got up around $500 and $600 a ton. This year, we're back, you know, the kind of lows we've seen for maybe a decade or so, particularly on navel oranges, of $50 to $100 a ton. So you can see how the pendulum has swung in one extreme to high prices, now back in the other extreme to low prices. So hopefully by the time everybody's stocks of product are kind of cleared and settled down, we'll get a juice price that's somewhere between those highs and the lows that's a bit more reasonable.
Knowing that the prices, and this, you said there's been a bit of a global consumer backlash in terms of the juice prices, are you expecting demand for Australian oranges and Australian juice to go down from the US, knowing that they'll be even higher? Or
the US buys whole fruit, like particularly blood oranges or mandarins and navel oranges. I don't imagine anybody in Australia would be sending or selling the US very much juice product. That would be going to Asia or New Zealand, but mostly within Australia. What has really happened is because prices have gone so high on juice, consumers have either stopped buying juice or they're buying apple juice or some other juice. And now that the prices have come back, you don't, let's say we lost 20% in sales, which is roughly what our juice sales dropped by, and I think that's typical. Now that we're running specials and we've got our juice prices for consumers, I'm talking the price that a consumer would pay for a 2 litre of juice, that's back to about where it was. You don't necessarily recover the whole of the 20%, because people quite often, you know, if they bought something else, they'll stay with that. If they decide they like apple juice or carrot and something, or a vegetable juice or something, or just don't buy juice at all, decide to drink bottled water, well, you don't necessarily recover what you lost.
That's Jeff Nispel, the Joint Managing Director at the South Australian juice company Nippies. He was speaking there with Shannon Pierce.
G'day, Tony from Tarina, Darwin and Mackerel Online. I am a second generation commercial Spanish mackerel fisherman and I'm also a shop manager for our seafood shop. And you're listening to The Country Hour.
Fiona Broome with you this afternoon on The Country Hour, 18 minutes past one. Still ahead on the show, we're going to check in with the NT Rural Women's Award winner, see what she's been up to over the past few months. Here's some Darius Rucker. Wagon Wheel from Darius Rucker. I will never get sick of that song. 22 minutes past one here on The Country Hour. Fiona Broome with you this afternoon. Well, a few months ago, Christy Hollis was named the winner of this year's NT Rural Women's Award. Christy's a naturopath based in Palmerston. I caught up with her before the awards ceremony in April to find out a little bit about her work.
Honestly, we take on a lot of stuff as women and we really don't take that special self-care. We always seem to be giving to others, whether it's for like within our community, with our families and friends. So they usually are the last person to come for that space and get support. It's definitely, and there's definitely spaces that we can help with in naturopathic practices.
How did you come into this space?
Look, I've been interested in naturopathy or complementary medicine since I literally was a small child. My nan introduced me to playing with herbs in her garden and aromatherapy. And look, I took a turn into science. I've always wanted to be able to work in that space too. So I did, and I ended up getting a traineeship with CSIRO and working in the space of entomology. But that entomology required me to eradicate weeds, which were actually, now that I'm a herbalist, those are the things that I call herbs. And I went, I need to go back and do some more studies and become a naturopath. So that was 23 years ago that I graduated. So I've been working in this space for a long time now.
Christy Hollis there. She was named the NT Rural Women's Award winner in April. And since winning that award, Christy tells me she has been absolutely flat chat.
So since then, it's been very busy basically making connections with those rural and regional communities, reaching out to different potential collaborators. So from Indigenous people to other initiatives in recreational space too. So trying to get my Women's Business Nurture and Thrive project on the ground in those more regional areas. It's been exciting and lots of groundwork happening in the background.
Which areas are you looking to move into?
So I'm in talking currently out at Galawinku and also down out of the Strongbella Mines Women's Centre space down there in Katherine. So at the moment, and also got a project, just a small community project happening in Bachelor in a couple of weeks' time.
Is that because there's been some interest in the work that you've been doing over the past couple of months? Have people been reaching out to you for your support?
Yeah, definitely. So the women down in Katherine want me to assist them in the a women's circle space for the Banajal Strong Women's Program. So I'm definitely doing that at the moment. I've also been creating some women's booklets on different health topics alongside a local Indigenous artist, and she's done some wonderful imaging for me to utilise through those booklets. That's Tiara Cole. I'm really excited to have those printed in the near future too to be able to use in this project.
Has winning the NT Rural Women's Award brought you a bit of a profile? Have you been in touch with a lot more people across the territory because they've heard of you through the award?
Yes, definitely. So I've spoken at a couple of events recently as well, especially women's events, and yeah, just making those connections further in the different community spaces to make sure that I can take, you know, make the most out of this possibilities for everything. So I'm really excited to be able to get into those more remote community areas, hopefully in the near future.
And you're going a bit further afield this week. You're in Canberra. Tell me what's happening in Canberra.
So in Canberra, we have the AgriFutures Stakeholder Summit, which is running basically from Sunday through till Thursday. So at this place, we're actually going to all be coming together, all the national finalists, and putting our pitch together, the final tweaks, and have judging on the Tuesday. So that's where we're standing in front of the judging panel, giving our 15-minute pitch, having a 30-minute question time, digging deeper into our projects. And, yeah, hopefully we don't actually find out the winner, though, until the end of October. So it's a big, a whole lot of work going on next week post-judging, interacting with the Horizons scholars who are part of the AgriFutures section as well, and also meeting up with ministers from federal ministers at Parliament House, and another gala dinner and media training and all sorts of things going on. Very busy week.
Also, since winning the award here in the Northern Territory, it sounds like it's just been a bit of a whirlwind.
Definitely has been a whirlwind. A lot of work going on in the background that people probably don't realise. It's not just an award that you're given, it's an award that you work for.
All the best with it this week in Canberra, Christy. Do wish you all the best, and hopefully we've got some more exciting news to share later in the year.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you so much, Fiona, and thanks for having me.
The Classic 100 Piano Highlights album is out now. Four CDs of Australia's favourite piano music. Get your copy at abc.net.au/classic/shop.
Time now to head on over to the Roma Sale Yards. David Friend has the results for us there.
Numbers increased once again, where Roma agents yarded 10,189 head, consisting of over 5,000 steers, almost 3,000 heifers and 2,300 cows. All the regular process of feedlot background is present and active. At the time of this interim report, bullocks to 374, heavy feeders to 414 and Angus cross steer weaners to 470 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 200 to 280 kilos, topping at 470. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, the majority selling from 356 to 470 cents a kilo. Yearling steers 330 to 400 kilos made to 460 to average 394. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos sold to 414. Yearling steers over 480 kilos, topping at 390 cents to processors, and bullocks over 600 kilos to 374 cents a kilo. This has been David Friend from the National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you, David, bringing us the results from the Roma store sale. That is all the time we have on the Country Hour today. My name's Fiona Broom. Thank you for your company. Stick around. Arvo's with Jess Ong coming up next on your ABC. I'll be back with you tomorrow. Until then, keep it rural.